In a speech on Thursday night, Republican presidential candidate Carly Fiorina declared that conservative policies help women more than liberal ones. And she has repeatedly attacked Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton as being all talk on women's issues. Good morning. John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we'll talk about the gender politics at play in the 2016 presidential race and what the political landscape looks like for women hoping to succeed in politics. My guest this hour is Jennifer Lawless, Professor of Government and Director of the Women and Politics Institute at American University. Professor Lawless, welcome to the Joy Cardine program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start out by having you tell us something about the work of the Women and Politics Institute.
We are located at American University, and our mission is to close the gender gap in political leadership. So we conduct research, lead programs, and hold special events to call attention to women's underrepresentation in the political sphere, identify the obstacles that are keeping women from running for office, and assessing how we can get more women involved.
Okay, so why in 2015 don't we have more women in politics? What are some of the obstacles? What are some of the reasons we don't see more women either running for office or holding office?
Well, the good news is that there does not seem to be bias on the part of the media or voters, which often flies in the face of what people tend to think. When women run for office, they do just as well as the men against whom they compete. They receive comparable media coverage, they receive the same number of votes, and they raise the same amount of money. The main barrier is that women are far less likely than men to run in the first place for two reasons. They're less likely to think they're qualified to run, even when on paper they have the exact same qualifications, and they're less likely to be encouraged to run. And that's the case whether we're talking about family members, colleagues, and friends, or more official political gatekeepers like party activists or elected officials. They just don't encourage women to run at the same rates as they do men.
But let's go back to the media for just a second, because, I mean, one of the narratives out there about how the media covers candidates is we didn't get any stories in the last presidential election, for example, about which of the candidates had a better suit or what they were wearing at all, or if it looked like they'd been working out. And these are the kind of stories we often get about women candidates. Doesn't the media have a part to play in this?
Well, I'm not sure that I would agree with you. We knew Paul Ryan's workout routine pretty well, and we also know that he wore a lot of ill-fitting suits. The same thing can be said about Chris Christie this time around. So I don't want to suggest that the media don't cover candidates' appearance, but when they do, they're just as likely to be covering men as women. And let me just highlight for a minute some of the data that claim is based on. Danny Hayes, who's a professor of political science at George Washington University, and I have spent the last few years collecting virtually every newspaper article from the largest circulating newspaper in every congressional district across the country. We have focused our analysis on congressional candidates, and our assessment of roughly 11,000 newspaper articles about candidates running for Congress finds that the volume and the substance of coverage looks almost identical. Women and men are equally likely to be considered strong leaders and to be competent. They're equally likely to be described as empathetic or having integrity. They're associated with the same kinds of issues, and they're equally likely to have their appearance covered. I'm sorry. Most importantly, though, 99.3% of the coverage never mentions a candidate's appearance. So we think that what's happening is that although presidential politics are a little bit different and the information environment is bigger and there are more opportunities to cover candidates in what could potentially be a sexist way, it's still just not that common. When it happens, though, it winds up getting a ton of coverage on its own. And I think that perpetuates the idea that women face a far more onerous campaign environment than men do.
Why should gender matter at all in elections or in how we discuss them?
Well, it's becoming less of a salient consideration, I think, because we've seen such a high level of party polarization that whether a candidate has a D or an R in front of their name is a far more useful cue to voters than whether that candidate has an X or Y chromosome. And so if you know that a candidate is a Democrat or a Republican, you know almost everything you need to know about that candidate. That said, when women are elected and they're in positions of political power, they are a little bit more likely than men to focus on issues that have to deal with women, families, and children. That's not to say that they're going to cross party lines, but within each party, women are more likely than men to prioritize those issues. There's also some evidence to suggest that the more women we have in positions of political power, the more likely that conveys to the next generation that politics is open to them. So there are both substantive and symbolic reasons that having women in positions of political power is important for a democracy.
You were quoted as saying that now is an especially good time to be a woman running for office. What makes this true?
Two things. The first is that we are now at the pinnacle of party polarization. So it's almost impossible to find people who cross party lines, which means that your party identification and if you're congruent with the voters, it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. They just don't factor sex into their assessments. The second reason is that the electoral landscape now is such that although women are severely underrepresented, they're just not that novel. And so when journalists are covering races, when donors are giving to candidates, they're not thinking foremost about whether the candidate is a man or a woman. And so if you have a good platform, if you have the ability to raise money, if you're willing to speak to journalists and get your message out there, it's kind of incidental whether you're a man or a woman.
800-642-1234, the number to call to join the program today and ask a question of our guest or make a comment, 800-642-1234. Email address is talk@WPR.org. You can also find the Joy Cardine Show on Facebook. Look for the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page and leave your comment or question there. We're talking about what the political landscape looks like for women in 2016 and particularly for women hoping to succeed in politics. And in general, what role do you think gender will play in the 2016 presidential race? Do Hillary Clinton or Carly Fiorina have a better chance with women or with you? Should female candidates talk about gender as part of their campaign? And which party has the better policies for America's women? 800-642-1234. Jennifer Lawless is my guest. She is a professor of government and director of the Women and Politics Institute at American University. In a speech last week, Republican presidential candidate Carly Fiorina said that conservative policies help women more than liberal ones and are also more feminist. What kind of move is she making here?
Well, I think what she's trying to do is suggest to female voters that if they think it's important to elect a woman, if they consider themselves feminists, they have a choice beyond Hillary Clinton. I also think there's very little substance to that statement. There's no question that women are more likely than men to be registered as Democrats, that women are more likely than men to vote as Democrats, and that Democrats are more likely than Republicans to espouse and hold policy preferences that are consistent with a feminist agenda, from equal pay to reproductive rights to access to child care and universal pre-K. It's just a fact. And so I think that Carly Fiorina's statements are an attempt to demonstrate that she cares about female voters, but the policies that she's supporting are actually not consistent with the way that we would traditionally characterize a feminist agenda.
And let's talk about Carly Fiorina for just a moment. She's running as a Republican in a it's a crowded field, and that's putting it mildly. And right now, she doesn't seem to be getting a ton of traction, but she is getting noticed by the media. Do you think that? Do you think she's being noticed by the media because of the novelty of her candidacy, or because of what she's saying, or why is she getting coverage now?
Well, I think there are a couple of different things going on. The first is, in part, the novelty of her candidacy, both because she's the only woman in a crowded male field and because she is trying to position herself as a viable alternative to Hillary Clinton as a woman, which the other candidates are not doing. They're trying, obviously, to position themselves as a viable alternative as a Republican. I also think part of the reason that Carly Fiorina is generating the kind of attention she is because we tend not to see two female candidates compete against each other. And although they're technically not competing against each other, both need to get through the Democratic and Republican primaries first, the idea of two women facing off in the general election would certainly be new and noteworthy.
800-642-1234, the number to call to join the program if you have a question for Professor Lawless about, this 2016 campaign and how women are relating to it. What's the atmosphere like for women running for public office today? Do we need more women in public office, or it doesn't really matter what the gender is as long as the job gets done? What do you think about all of this? 800-642-1234. Professor Lawless, should women be more drawn to female candidates, and are they?
Well, there's a significant gender gap in American politics in which female voters are more drawn to Democratic candidates. And Democratic candidates are more likely to field women. The Democratic Party is more likely to field women. So 70% of the candidates who are women who run for office tend to be Democrats. As a result, because women in the population are more Democratic, they tend to support women candidates at a greater level. But it's not because they're women. It's because of their party affiliation. Okay. In terms of whether they should be drawn to them or not, a lot of it depends on what matters most in an election. For most people, it's their policy preferences, and those preferences tend to be determined by whether they're Democrats or Republicans. There are a chunk of people, however, for whom gender consciousness plays a major role. And at the presidential level in particular, there is a sliver of the population that wants to make sure that in their lifetime they see a female president. And so for those people, certainly the fact that Hillary Clinton or Carly Fiorina is a woman could be very helpful. In only a few cases is it true that people will vote against a female candidate simply because she's a woman. That kind of overt sexism just doesn't seem to rear its head anymore. Again, in part because the parties are so different from each other that even a card-carrying sexist would be hard-pressed not to vote for a female candidate if she shares that person's party affiliation.
Well, Hillary Clinton launched her campaign with a speech on Saturday in what was also a detailed list of policy plans. She said, "I may not be the youngest candidate in this race, but I will be the youngest woman president in the history of the United States." Is Hillary trying to make that kind of historic appeal that you talked about a moment ago?
I think she is. And I think part of the reason that she's doing so is because we saw in 2008 that was a pretty successful message. She just started making that speech a little bit too late in the campaign. But at the end, in her final speech, when she said that she might not be the one to break the highest, hardest glass ceiling, but it has 18 million cracks in it, that line really resonated with people. So I think we're going to see more of that. The other thing to keep in mind is that although the sex of the candidate might not determine how somebody casts a vote, it is certainly the case that she has an ability to appeal to female voters to be more enthusiastic, to campaign on her behalf, to donate to her campaign, to knock on doors, and to generate the level of enthusiasm that Barack Obama was able to generate among young people when he ran in 2008. And so I think it's important to realize that the gender dynamics of the presidential election campaign have more to do with what's going on behind the scenes and how excited people can get than vote choice, probably.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have more with Jennifer Lawless, Professor of Government and Director of the Women in Politics Institute at American University. We're talking about the atmosphere for women in politics in 2015 as we head into the 2016 presidential election year, and wondering what you think about this. How do you see this issue? Is this something that you care about? Do you think gender is going to play a role in the 2016 race? What a female candidate, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Carly Fiorina, have a better chance with you? 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org or find the Joy Cardine Show on Facebook. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network. What's the atmosphere for women in politics in 2016? What's the landscape look like for women hoping to succeed in the political arena? We're talking about that this hour with Jennifer Lawless, professor, government, and director of the Women in Politics Institute at American University. And with you at 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org or find us on Facebook. And that's exactly what Peter and Gary have both done. Peter writes, I refuse to vote with my private parts. Expecting women to do so indicates a fundamental lack of respect for women. Gary on Facebook says, just say no thank you to identity politics. Well, Professor Lawless, is it disrespectful to women to expect women to vote for other women?
I'm not sure that women expect women to vote for other women. And I don't know that it's disrespectful. I think people come up with a lot of different reasons to make the choices they make when they're casting a vote. And for those who actually prioritize the importance of the sex of a candidate, if it is identity politics and it is a way for them to think that they can be represented because for so long the political system has excluded people based on race or color or socioeconomic status, then I think that's legitimate. It's not very common. But whatever reasons people use to determine what they think would make for a better set of our political institutions, I think, you know, is a very individual, personalized decision. What I will come back to, though, is the idea that it's just really quite rare. Most people that leave the House on Election Day and take the time to cast a vote are doing so not because of identity politics, but because they want to make sure that they're being represented by somebody who understands their interests and who will represent their best interests. So if people use sex as a cue, the same way that they use party as a cue to make that decision, that's a pretty useful information shortcut. But again, it's just not that common.
With, Republicans, including Carly Fiorina, have criticized Hillary Clinton for receiving money via the Clinton Foundation from countries where women are not free. Do you think this criticism undermines her branding as a feminist candidate?
I don't. I think we would be hard-pressed to find a candidate out there on either side of the aisle and, quite frankly, throughout time, who has done more for women in the United States and globally. Right? Hillary Clinton is the person who came up with the phrase women's rights are human rights. And since the since the early 1990s, she really has been a champion for women's rights. So it's also important to realize that she is not the Clinton Foundation per se. That's Bill Clinton. And I do think one of the challenges that she's going to face over the course of this election cycle is having to differentiate herself from her husband, from his positions, from his foundation. But as voters, it's important for people to keep in mind that any discrepancies are not examples of flip-flopping. You can look at her Senate record or her record as Secretary of State and potentially accuse her of flip-flopping. But she and her husband are two very different people. So I think those charges are somewhat unfair.
In Carly Fiorina's speech and the presence of women in both major parties running for president, can we expect to see more debate over who is better for women as the race continues?
Well, we saw in the 2014 midterm elections quite a bit of debate about that. So I would expect that we would see who is better for women regardless of who the nominees are. There is a gender gap in presidential elections. In every presidential election since 1980, women have been more likely than men to vote for the Democratic candidate. And so Democrats are particularly successful when they exploit that gender gap, and Republicans are successful when they're able to mitigate it. So vying for the women's vote is something that all candidates tend to do.
Let's take a phone call here. John is with us from Milwaukee. John, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to say that to me, the sex of the politician doesn't matter. But I did want to point out that it doesn't seem fair of your guest to say that women are underrepresented. I think what you mean to say is that they just don't run as often. They have the same amount of representation in their vote. And in fact, more women vote. But I would compare it to the STEM fields because it is important to encourage women to run for office and be in a STEM field. But at the end of the day, I mean, if they don't want to, then I guess I would say that's their personal choice.
All right, John, thanks for the call. Professor Lawless?
Well, I think there are 2 points that come out of that call. One, I completely agree with, which is that women's votes do matter and women actually do comprise a greater share of the electorate. So when I say that women are underrepresented, I mean that they're numerically underrepresented in our political institutions. 80% of the members of Congress, 88% of state governors, 90% of big city mayors, and 75% of statewide elected officials and state legislators are men. So that's a huge gap when you compare it to the fact that women are more than 50% of the population. The part of the call that I don't agree with is that women just don't want to run. Over the course of the last 15 years, Richard Fox and I have done extensive research and written several books about why women don't run for office. And it's not that they're thinking about it and then deciding that they would rather pursue an alternative career. It's that it never occurs to them in the first place in a way that it does men. And if something doesn't appear on your radar screen, then it's not something that you can systematically assess and then decide to do or not to do. And as long as women are more likely than men to doubt their qualifications, to lack the confidence to run for office, and to have those self-doubts reinforced by a political arena that does not recruit female candidates as frequently as it does men, then I'm very reluctant to say that it's women who just don't want to run. I think it's women who don't have that option presented to them.
John, thank you so much for your call and for sharing your insights with us. You could join us also on the phone at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. There's a spot for you. Okay, so once they decide to run, do women have any additional challenges to overcome, even assuming the media and voters are not biased, which we've pretty much already established? For example, do they have a more difficult time finding donors than male candidates?
They don't. Women raise just as much money as men do when they win when they run for office, whether they win or lose their elections. And they also are just as able to spend that money well, right? So it's not like women have to raise more to win an election. There are, however, a few things that suggest that gender is still relevant. The first is that anecdotal evidence suggests that women have to spend more time raising money than men to get the same amount of dollars, and that's certainly significant. The other is that when there's a woman in the race, the interpersonal dynamics between the candidates change. And that means that both the male and female candidates running have to, in some ways, recalibrate at least a little bit. And the best example I can give you of that is the famous Rick Lazio moment during the 2000 New York State Senate debate between Hillary Clinton and Rick Lazio, where Rick Lazio walked across the stage and waved in the front of Hillary Clinton's face a document that he wanted her to sign where she would make a campaign pledge. And the basic narrative that came out of that was that he was just too aggressive. It wasn't appropriate. It was certainly not appropriate to be that aggressive and to invade the space of a woman. And over the course of the last year, Danny Hayes and I have done interviews, extensive interviews, with many campaign managers in the last few election cycles, and they've said that that Rick Lazio moment in a lot of ways shapes the way that they try to control interpersonal dynamics between their candidates and their opponents. And there are just certain things that you can't say to a woman. There are certain things that a woman can't say. There are certain sexist connotations that emerge based on, you know, individual graphics, for example, that candidates will want to avoid. And so I don't want to suggest that gender is not at all relevant. It is very relevant. It's just that when there's a woman in the race, both she and often her male opponent have to recalibrate.
800-642-1234, the number to call to join our program here. We're talking about the atmosphere for women running for political office here in 2015 and 2016. Of course, the presidential year coming up. And with Jennifer Lawless, professor of government and director of the Women and Politics Institute at American University. Carly Fiorina, nowhere near the front runner in a Republican race for president right now, but she's focused on Hillary Clinton. Is this a strategy that is going to help her distinguish herself from her male counterparts?
I think it will. We do know that when there is a crowded field, being a woman in a primary can often be an advantage because it sets that candidate apart. And what we're seeing with Carly Fiorina's strategy is that she's setting herself apart not only because she's a woman, but also because she's trying to position herself as the only candidate who can take away any advantage that Hillary Clinton might have for being a woman. And so she's right now already playing into the general electorate, whereas most of the other Republican candidates at this point are probably trying to differentiate themselves from one another so that they garner that nomination.
Governor Scott Walker, Wisconsin's governor and a presumptive candidate for president, although he hasn't officially declared, it's a campaign in all but name, recently said, he was the best one positioned to run against Hillary Clinton because he'd already defeated a woman. His opponent in the last gubernatorial election in Wisconsin was a woman, and he pulled that card out. Is that an example of the kind of thing we're going to hear more of?
I wouldn't be surprised if we actually don't hear much more of that for a couple of reasons. The first is that presidential politics is obviously unlike other levels of elected office, and what it takes to win a presidential election is obviously a much bigger scale and quite different from what's involved in winning statewide office or a congressional seat. The other reason I think we probably won't hear it that much is because it suggests that all women are the same. And I don't think that that's a message that is ultimately going to resonate. Just because you can defeat one female candidate does not mean that you can defeat every female candidate. And my hunch is that the Democrats would be well situated to turn that message into one in which it seems like Scott Walker is somewhat disrespectful to female candidates by lumping them all together. So I don't know, there's no reason to expect that he feels that way or that that's what he meant, but I think that lines like that can ultimately play into a narrative that wouldn't be very helpful.
Let's take some more phone calls. We'll go to Milwaukee, where John is with us. John, hello.
Oh, good morning. I just called in to say that I'm looking forward to voting for a female president. Right now, I'm planning on voting for Bernie Sanders in the primary, but I imagine in the general election, it'll be Hillary, which I can accept. But I would like to see a woman president, especially to inspire the young girls out there to get involved in politics. My top choice candidate, as I told your trainer, is Dr. Jill Stein of the Green Party, but I don't think that's going to happen.
All right, John, thank you so much. So John is planning to vote for Bernie Sanders in the primary, but he would support Hillary in the general election. He thinks it's time to break those gender barriers and have a woman president, for no other reason than as an inspiration to other young women to run for politics.
And I think that that's a lot of what we are going to see. But what's also particularly interesting in his statements was that in the primary, he was not going to support Hillary Clinton, right? He's going to support the candidate that he thinks is probably closer to him, and that's Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary. And then in the general election, he's excited to support Hillary Clinton. But she's also the Democratic candidate. And so that's very common, right? We see the people who want to support the female candidate often also would be supporting that party's nominee anyway. And that's why it's so difficult to determine the extent to which it's sex versus party that drives political behavior.
Let's go back to Carly Fiorina for just a moment. Before she entered the race, Fiorina said that if she ran, Clinton couldn't, quote, play the gender card, end quote. What does the presence of a woman on the other side of the party line do to Clinton's campaign? Let's say that Carly Fiorina managed to win the Republican nomination and we had two women running for president. Well, that would be historic, for one thing. But what does that do to Clinton's campaign?
I think what it does is it suggests that any of the people that were independents or that were willing to cross over from their party because they wanted to be able to elect a female candidate in their lifetime now have choices. That's a very real thing, but it's also a very small percentage of the population. And so there are really, once you take into account party affiliation, very few undecided voters and very few people who cross party lines under any circumstances. So it's true that a female Republican candidate could chip away at any advantage Hillary Clinton would have among that very, very small sliver of voters. But it's still a very, very small sliver of voters.
How much weight does breaking barriers carry in 2016, do you think? After President Obama broke barriers in 2008, are we likely to want to do it again, or are we satisfied for now? I mean, you have Wayne LaPierre, I believe it was, the NRA, taking a shot at this and saying we don't really need any more, what was it, I'm thinking, demographically unique or something. I'm trying to remember the exact quote that he used, but it was basically, okay, we've had a black president, we're all done with that now.
Yeah, so we haven't had a female president. The United States currently ranks 99th globally in the percentage of women in the national legislature. And we have a series of policies in this country that are just not fair for women. The reality is that women are still making 78 cents on a man's dollar. And so I think symbolically it's important at some point to demonstrate that America is willing and ready to elect a female president. I don't know if that will be this election cycle. I don't know if it will be Hillary Clinton. But it's been forever, and it's kind of time, especially considering that we go into other nations, we help them rewrite their constitutions, we help fledgling democracies, and in doing so, we suggest that they should actually have gender quotas. Now, that's a standard to which we would never hold ourselves, but it suggests that we believe that it's important. And so I do think there is something about democratic legitimacy and something about simple justice that would suggest that eventually the White House should be open to candidates not only of all races, but also of both sexes.
Let's get another call in here. Victor in West Allis will be next. Victor, hello.
Well, good morning. I enjoy your program, like always. I kind of disagree with your professor there. I think Hillary is not the best candidate because a lot of people, from what I hear, don't trust her, okay? She has a lot of baggage that she's got to get rid of. I think a lot of people say they wish Elizabeth Warren was out there because they trust her, because during the bank crisis, she was on 60 Minutes blasting the heck out of the banks. And I think in the upcoming year and the next 4 years, I think you're going to see some top females come out. But like everything else, like a male, and you hear this from the past, why trust him? He thinks the same way I do. I think in the next 4 years, you're going to see women coming out, but they're going to have to project a trustworthiness.
Victor, thanks for your call and for sharing your perspective. Victor thinks Hillary won't make it. She's got too much baggage.
There's no question that she has baggage. She probably has more baggage than any presidential candidate has ever had, just because she's been in the public eye pretty much nonstop since Bill Clinton's 1991 candidacy. Her big challenge, and I think we saw her trying to overcome some of these obstacles in the speech on Saturday, is to suggest to people that not only is she a strong, competent leader, where most people already score her pretty high, but that she's empathetic and trustworthy, where there's still quite a bit of room for growth. Campaigns allow candidates to make that case to the voters, though, and we'll see what she's able to do. I also agree with the caller that there are a lot of other female candidates who may emerge in the future. But it's important to realize, too, that most of the names floating around of potential female presidential candidates, whether it be Elizabeth Warren or Amy Klobuchar or Claire McCaskill, come from the Senate. There had also been names like Kathleen Sebelius or Janet Napolitano, who had been governors but then had been sucked into the Obama administration. In most cases, the people who are successful presidential candidates are governors of states, and that's where women are actually the most fundamentally underrepresented. So although the pipeline has a handful of women who would probably make excellent candidates, there aren't that many female gubernatorial candidates out there who would be the most obvious choices.
All right. We'll talk about we're going to take a break, and I want, when we come back, Professor Lawless, I want to talk about Hillary Clinton's 2008 campaign and how gender may have played into that, and maybe how this year could be different. We'll do that in just a moment. And we'll take more of your calls and questions, 800-642-1234, or you can find us on Facebook. Look for the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Leave your comment or question there. I'm John Munson. In for Joy Cardine, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. What's the atmosphere for women in politics in 2015? That's the question this hour on the Joy Cardine Show. Jennifer Lawless is my guest, professor of government and director of the Women in Politics Institute at American University. 800-642-1234, the number to call to join the program, 800-642-1234. Well, Professor, let's talk a little bit about Hillary Clinton's 2000 campaign and how that went. How did gender play into that campaign, and why would we expect 2016 to be different?
There is no question that gender played a role, and it played a role, I think, on a few different dimensions. The first is that the 2008 Democratic primary sort of worked under the assumption early on, at least from the Clinton campaign, that women would automatically be inclined to vote for Hillary Clinton. And we saw, first, that that was not the case, and second, that Barack Obama was actually able to get a large chunk of women in various demographic groups on board early on. And so I think that what the lesson we're seeing learned there is that this time around, Hillary Clinton is not counting on anybody's vote, and she's appealing specifically to female voters in the Democratic primary the minute she got out of the gate. The second way that it mattered was that the media were not as careful as they should have been. You know, when I said earlier that when women run for office, they garner the same kind of media coverage, we don't know if that's the case in presidential elections because there's only been one very serious, high-profile female presidential candidate. And we don't know if Hillary Clinton was treated the way she was because she was a woman or because she's Hillary Clinton. But the kinds of things that pundits and even other politicians and journalists said about her, even if that was a pretty small proportion of the overall commentary, was often quite sexist. And I think this time around we're going to see people be a lot more careful in how they describe her just because they don't want to violate the kinds of journalistic norms that are important to their organization's bottom line.
Unlike Carly Fiorina, the male Republican candidates in the Republican presidential race are not talking about Clinton's gender. Should they be?
I don't think so. It doesn't behoove candidates in general to call attention to their sex or the sex of their opponent. Now, in Hillary Clinton's case, it does because it would be newsworthy. It would break this glass ceiling. It would be the first time that something like electing a female president would happen. But as far as the other candidates are concerned, calling attention to her sex would only actually make salient in voters' minds the fact that she's well-situated to break that glass ceiling. And so it just doesn't seem like it would benefit them. They also probably want to avoid any claims of sexism, given that the Democrats have tried for the last several election cycles to paint the Republican Party as having declared a war on women. So anything they say that could be construed as sexist, the Democrats are going to get out there and they're going to push it.
We have a comment from Mary Kay on Facebook who says, Ms. Fiorina is the perfect example of why it is ridiculous to vote for someone based solely on gender or any other affiliation for that matter. Her stance is absolutely wrong and completely insulting to women. What do you think of what Mary Kay has to say, Jennifer Lawless?
Well, I think if you are a feminist who is pro-choice and pro-pay equity and believes in equal rights and universal health care and child care and the other kinds of issues that tend to define a feminist platform, then Mary Kay is right. Those are not the kinds of things that Carly Fiorina supports. And it's important for people to know that they can't assume that women and men are different in politics. It's much more likely that Democrats and Republicans are different in politics, and that party differential conveys far more information about what a candidate will do than whether that candidate is a man or a woman.
800-642-1234, the number to call to join the program. Tom has joined us from South Beloit, Illinois. We'll go there next. Tom, hello.
Good morning. Some of your earlier discussion prompted my question, and what that is for your guest is, do you think that there's a possibility that Carly Fiorina is actually running for vice president, as she's already started the attack dog position that a vice president is supposed to have, and that by being a woman, assuming Hillary's the Democratic presidential candidate, the Republican candidate won't have to sully himself by attacking a woman and turning off, you know, the undecided voters, or however you want to describe them, that she'll be able to, you know, go after Hillary as a woman, and it won't create problems for the Republican presidential candidate.
Tom, thanks for that call. Jennifer Lawless?
That's a great question. In fact, Katie Couric asked Carly Fiorina that very question. And Carly Fiorina responded with basically charges of sexism and said, oh, Katie, would you ever ask a male candidate that question? And Katie said, yes, she would. And in fact, the other male candidates had been asked similar questions. Are they just gunning for the VP slot? The reason, I don't know if that's what Carly Fiorina is doing. The reason, though, that I would expect that whoever the nominee is would not choose her is because she has never held elected office. And the Republicans do not want to be in a position like they were in 2008 with Sarah Palin, where it seems like they're just playing identity politics and that they are not taking seriously the fact that the vice president could ultimately be president of the United States. So given that very few of the Republican candidates have a lot of foreign policy experience, have a lot of sort of international relations credentials, I think it's unlikely that they would also choose as a vice presidential candidate somebody that is quite untested.
Well, and Carly Fiorina has never won an elected a post as an elected official. Is it possible that one of the reasons that she's running hard against Hillary is that she doesn't really have a public service record of her own to run on?
Sure. We know that when people try to run against the establishment or against an incumbent, they have two options. The first is to demonstrate why they're the better choice based on their record. The other is to demonstrate that they're the better choice based on taking down the opponent's record. And you pursue that latter path if you don't have one of your own. Now, she can say that she has a record in business and that she understands the economy in a way that a lot of other candidates don't. And maybe that's true. That's up for debate, I think. But the fact is, she has not been on a ballot in a way that has gotten her elected office. She's run for office, and she hasn't won. And so that's just, we don't elect as presidents of the United States people who have no previous electoral experience. Maybe I'll be proven wrong this time around, but I think it's unlikely.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Michael in Danbury. Michael, hello.
Hello, and thank you for listening. My question is simply, who could live in the shadow of Hillary as her running mate? I can't imagine anybody could stand there unless it's Bubba himself.
Well, you know, I'm not sure that anybody thought that Barack Obama's running mate would have the best options either, right? I mean, this is a person who emerged as the presidential nominee and walked on water. I think she'll be fine. I don't think she's going to have any trouble if she gets the nomination selecting a running mate who can balance her and maybe resonate with demographic groups that she finds a little bit more challenging. So I think that the list is long and that most people would say yes.
Michael, thanks for your call. As an observer, Professor Lawless, a broader question, how can we distinguish between treatment of female candidates that may be sexist as opposed to legitimate criticisms of their qualifications as candidates?
There are two things that we can do. The first is just the counterfactual of it. Would a man be asked this question, or would a man be covered in this way? And I can give you two examples. The first is the one that I just mentioned, where Carly Fiorina said to Katie Couric, would you ask a man that question? And when I looked into that, yes, almost every male candidate had been asked that same question. So that's not sexism. That's a bad experience. Another example is when Wendy Davis ran for governor of Texas, and she was covered for her filibuster, and a lot of the coverage mentioned the shoes she was wearing, these hot pink sneakers, because she was standing on her feet. A lot of groups came out and said, oh my gosh, we would never cover a male candidate this way. But it turned out that in the opening paragraph of Rand Paul's filibuster story, it also mentioned the shoes that he was wearing. And so if male and female candidates are covered the same way, it might be superficial coverage, it might not be particularly relevant, but it's probably not sexist. The other thing that we can do is look beyond the presidential level, where there are actually more cases. Hillary Clinton is such a unique candidate that it's very, very difficult to determine whether negative things that are said about her, even if they're not said about other candidates, are sexism or Clintonism. But if we look at gubernatorial candidates, at Senate candidates, at House candidates, the kinds of patterns that we're able to uncover can shed far more light on whether women and men are being treated the same or differently and why.
So how might the gender politics of this race change as the rest of the campaign unfolds? And if, for example, Carly Fiorina is eliminated during the primaries?
If she's eliminated during the primary, then I don't think we're going to actually see much attention to the gender gap or to women's issues until the general election comes around. So if she's one of the first candidates that is eliminated, then I think the Republican debates and the Republican field will look very much like it did in 2012, and we'll see a lot of the same kinds of discussions. If Hillary Clinton gets the nomination, then as soon as the general election kicks off and both parties have their candidates, I do think we will see a lot of effort on the Democratic side to mobilize and energize female voters because they're more likely to be Democrats. And if the Democratic turnout exceeds the Republican turnout, that's how the Democrat wins.
And the first primaries aren't until next February. What are
right.
you going to be watching for between now and then?
Well, I think on the Republican side, we need to notice whether there are any major gaffes, because it's possible that those are the kinds of gaffes that will then continue to generate the attention and could, in the early states, wind up meaning that that candidate will be eliminated. On the Democratic side, the question is really the extent to which Hillary Clinton finds herself with a race. Bernie Sanders, for example, is doing pretty well, and he's generating quite a bit of enthusiasm. I don't think it's enough to win, but Hillary Clinton does not need a situation where her credentials are questioned to such an extent that it would actually make Democrats not less likely to vote for her, but less likely to turn out. So I think she's going to take the primaries very, very seriously and fight for Democratic votes, not because she's worried about losing the Democratic primary, but because she wants people to be really excited to get behind her when she wins the primary and needs their support in the general.
If Hillary Clinton does not win in 2016, how long do you think it might be before we have a woman in the White House?
I think it could be quite some time, because it's unclear who the next crop of Democratic candidates who are women could be. I know that people mention Elizabeth Warren all the time, Claire McCaskill. They're not young. And so they would actually, assuming that Hillary Clinton is the nominee and she loses, and that a Republican would be in the White House for 8 years, at that point, people like Elizabeth Warren and Claire McCaskill would actually be older than Hillary Clinton is now when they would run for president in 2024. And so, you know, it's not completely obvious who those candidates would be, but regardless of whether Clinton wins or loses, I think one of the most important things that both parties can do is encourage more women to run for office. Because only if we have them in Congress, only if we have more female governors, do we have a pipeline where women's electoral fortunes are not contingent on one particular woman making it through a race.
All right. Jennifer Lawless, thank you for joining me this hour. It's been an interesting discussion.
Thank you.
Jennifer Lawless is a professor of government and director of the Women in Politics Institute at American University. Christy Taylor produced this program with on-air production help from Cheryl Gasser, and Christy Taylor also handled direction. And in case anyone's wondering, I'm wearing New Balance 407s this morning. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oklahoma now has 5 times as many earthquakes as California. But is the state ready to handle it?
If it were to happen directly under...